Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Jordan Lawrence, Senior Counsel and Senior Vice President of the Office of Strategic Initiatives for the Alliance Defending Freedom at its Washington, D.C. Regional Service Center. Mr. Lawrence has litigated religious liberty, free speech, and marriage cases across the nation since 1984, after earning his law degree from the University of Minnesota Law School in 1980. If we're lucky, perhaps we can get him to say Yahweh during today's interview to prove if he's really from Minnesota. Listen carefully. He is admitted to the bar in three states, the U.S. Supreme Court, and multiple federal courts, and a little-known fact is that he was also a third-place contestant on Jeopardy at one point in time. On a tangential note, we here at Research on Religion are on a mission to get to 500 followers on our Facebook fan page by the time we reach 200 episodes, which will be in about a month, and we're very close to that 500 mark. So if you haven't visited us at Facebook already, please do, and we'd appreciate it if you could tell a friend, family member, clergy, or colleague about our free educational show. We'd enjoy the company. All right, now back to the show. Jordan, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, it's good to be here.
Very good. And are you really from Minnesota?
I was born and raised in Minnesota, but my parents were not from there, so that's why I don't have the, kind of way of talking about me. Although my wife says that when I go back and visit relatives that I begin to kind of talk that way after a while. But I was born and raised there, and the Tonka Toys the Tonka Trucks started in Minnesota. That I grew up in a western suburb on the shores of Lake Minnetonka, and that's where it started back in the 1940s. So they went for the alliteration for Tonka Toys and shorten it. And before they moved the factory to Mexico, it was a rite of passage. And I did this one summer, making mighty dumps on the assembly line at the Tonka Toys factory in Mound, Minnesota.
Wow, that is very cool. So if I said Tonka Toys, would you have said, what is Lake Minnetonka? Because you're on a Jeopardy contestant.
Yes. I mean, that would be it, because I would have known that they took off the non-alliterative M-I-N-N-E, to make it Tonka, the alliterative Tonka Toys.
Oh, very interesting.
The guy that started Tonka Toys went to my church when I was growing up, and Russ Wangstern, so my Minnesota roots are go way back. The best Minnesota meal you can have, which is really worth, is getting wild rice and walleye pike that is cooked the right way in butter, and usually have to go up to the Lake Wobegon areas of the northern part of the state where the lit up beer sign and the deer antlers on the pine paneling to really get it done the right way.
I can imagine. Yeah, having grown up in Wisconsin, I kind of have a little bit of that background.
Yes.
Anyways, we could talk about Minnesota forever here, but we are actually here to talk about court cases involving religious liberty and property, one of my favorite topics here. But I have another question I have to ask you before we dive into that, because I am always impressed by folks who have been admitted to the bar before the U.S. Supreme Court. It seems like such an intimidating place to argue a case. You get very limited time, and you really have to be at the top of your game to be at that level.
Yes.
Have you had the opportunity to argue any cases before our esteemed group of nine judges?
I have argued one case. It was back in 1999, the Southworth versus University of Wisconsin compelled speech case. And I've sat at conference at the council table several other times, and I've helped many, many people over the years with their cases. And, this year, for example, the town of Greece versus Galloway case back in November. That's an ADF case, as well as one of the two HHS mandate cases that were argued in March. So it's been a busy year for it. And then I just help out a lot of others, you know, moot court panels. And it is very intimidating, like you've said, that there's a whole different way that you have to argue because of the dynamic of the nine justices are, for the first time, feeling each other out where they stand on a case, and they're floating trial balloons. They're, you know, all sorts of stuff is going on, and you have to really be alert to that dynamic. It's much more so than, like, when I've argued at three-judge federal appeals courts, or even I've argued before seven different state Supreme Courts, and I would say that dynamic is even different than at the U.S. Supreme Court.
So those nine justices are essentially doing a little bit of dance, and you have to be aware of that that's going on. And I know you have limited time there, so every word right. that you use has to be really well chosen.
Well, you have to practice. In fact, I first learned this from John Roberts, who I first got to know in 1989 as a good friend of mine, and is now the Chief Justice of the United States, which is kind of weird when I talk to him now, and he's such a big guy. But he probably argued about 35, 38 or so cases before the Supreme Court, which is huge. I mean, I've done one, and that sets me into a very small band of privileged attorneys. You know, he did 38, I think, somewhere around in there. And he would take all of his arguments and put them in points into note cards and then reshuffle them so he could say them in any order. Because what you would get frequently at the court is you get somebody asking you a question, and it's point four in your outline. And you just have to, you know, you got to answer the question. You can't say, hey, just hold your horses, Justice so-and-so. I'll get to that in just a little bit. I mean, that would be death. You would never, ever do that. So you have to learn how to basically say your whole argument, you break it up into sort of these Lego pieces and reassemble it as the questions force you to do it in a different order. And that's how John Roberts would train, is by reshuffling the note cards.
That's fascinating. It'd be neat to just sit in on one of these things one time and watch the dance as they speak. I have one more beef with the Supreme Court, though, and maybe you can help me out with this, given that you're from Minnesota and I'm a Westerner. As far as I know, none of the nine judges that currently sit on the Supreme Court are anywhere or have lived anywhere west of Buffalo, New York. So it seems that the Westerners aren't getting any representation. So what can we do about that?
Well, you know, that is, I'm just running through. I think Kennedy is from California, but I think the rest, your comment is generally correct. And so, like, I know we're going to be talking about this Bronx Household of Faith case from New York City. And I've been thinking that I think four of the nine justices grew up in New York City, and Ginsburg and Sotomayor and Kagan and Scalia. And, I mean, you know, that's pretty geographically heavy on New York City people that are there. And then Alito is just down the road from New Jersey. So you're right.
Yeah, well, we need to get some Westerners on that thing.
Yes,
so.
I totally agree. People that maybe aren't necessarily, because I think everybody's been a federal judge except for Kagan, and they got to get a little more, professional diversity on the court.
Yeah. Well, let's get down to the real reason we're here today, and that's to talk about religious organizations and property, which actually, as I mentioned before, happens to be one of my favorite topics, believe it or not. I'm hoping to write my next book on churches and property rights, a topic that is of great importance, but one that typically flies under the radar of most scholars, news organizations, and even a lot of lawyers. What has drawn you into focusing on issues of religious property?
It's just that they happen. It's sort of like that's, like where the action is, where the litigation is. And it's not the only area where religious liberties are affected, but it does seem to happen quite a bit. And I think a part of it is due to the tax-exempt issues. So, like, if a church buys a piece of land in an area, it's going to become tax-exempt. And then the other thing is with these equal access cases about access of can a religious group use an empty government facility, like a school, a public school building, on the same terms and conditions as everybody else. And that litigation has somewhat diminished in the last few years, although we still got the big case in New York, the Bronx Household of Faith case. But back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, this was a very, very hot area of litigation. And I don't think it's been totally settled down now. And in fact, I'm concerned that we could have some eruptions in that as well. But I think it's so we get these separation of church and state concerns and these tax exemption issues, which I think create a lot of these issues.
Well, you mentioned the Bronx Household of Faith versus Board of Education of the City of New York, which is a very long title for a court case. Describe what this case is, because this is a nice starting point. It is a major case that is working its way through the courts. There was a decision recently on it. It has a temporary stay on it. But let's define what is going on here. Tell us about what is happening in the Bronx with this Household of Faith.
Well, what many people may find very surprising is that New York City does not allow religious groups to rent public schools on weekends, even though they're empty, to hold worship services. They have a specific ban on worship services, but you can do about anything else. I mean, a church could put on a first aid course. You can have a dance recital. You can have labor union meetings. You could even film episodes of Law and Order in a public school on the weekend, but you can't have a worship service. Now, we did some investigation, and just as a little compare and contrast, we looked at the facilities use policies of the 50 largest school districts in the country in terms of largest in terms of student population. And, New York City's number one, and number two through 50 all permitted. So if you go to Chicago, I think it's Los Angeles, Chicago is number three. Then it's Dade County, Florida, and Clark County, Nevada, where Las Vegas is, third, four, and five, and I can't remember which one is first. I think Dade County is four. They all permit it. And then, all, you know, right down the line to number 50. And New York City is leading a sort of one-city parade on banning worship services, which they've done for many, many years. So Bronx Household of Faith, small church in a poor area of the Bronx, been meeting in a house in other places since the early 1970s. In 1995, asked to use a neighborhood school. They were turned down, and they heard me on the radio and called me, and we filed the lawsuit. And it's had sort of a long sojourn. It's sort of like the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And we've been five times before the Federal Appeals Court, and we did lose recently, but we've appealed en banc to all 13 judges on the Second Circuit, which means the lower court injunction against the policy, declaring it unconstitutional, is still in effect. So as I speak to you today, as we record this today, religious groups, synagogues, churches are allowed to meet in New York City public schools for worship services. But I don't know how long that will be. And I would also add is that the mayor de Blasio has said he will repeal the policy, and he has the power to do that as the mayor. The school district is a subdivision of city government, but that has not happened as of today.
And I should mention that today is April 30th, the day that we are recording this. This will air in the second week of May. So for those of you keeping track of the time here, just to let you know where that is, in case anything happens over the next 2 weeks, we're not going to hold you responsible for anything that happens in the future here.
My prophetic gifting is not that well attuned yet.
Tell us a little bit about this Bronx Household Church. You mentioned that they were formed in the 1980s or so, and then in 1995, they must have gotten big enough to start looking around for some space. And, you know, space is hard to come by in New York City, pretty crowded city.
Right.
Are they a non-denominational church?
Yeah, they're a conservative evangelical church that was started back in 1973 by a young man from Texas and a young man from Minnesota who had met, and they and their wives were planning on being missionaries to the Middle East. I can't remember. I think it was to Lebanon. I can't remember what country it was now. But they ended up starting a church in a poor area of the Bronx. It's the University Heights area, if people are familiar with it, about six subway stops north of the Yankee Stadium. And they had a vision of being in a community, a Christian community, I mean, not like a monastery or something, but just have Christians living together near each other in a neighborhood and ministering to the poor people in the area. And the church has never been more than probably about 120 members. It's fluctuating probably between 80 and 120. But this little church has really had quite an impact with this lawsuit because I did say this case started in 1995, but from 2001 until today, April 30th, the churches have, there has been an injunction in effect one way or another that has allowed the religious groups to meet. So there has been sort of an uninterrupted time of, my math is bad, 13 years, or no, it's 2002, I'm sorry, of 12 years of religious groups being able to meet on the same terms and conditions as everybody else. Although the litigation fight is not over, I'm very proud of the professional accomplishment of being able to use my legal skills to keep the door open for these churches to meet in New York City for all those years.
Yeah, this is interesting to me because I have a friend who was running a Mosaic church out in New York, and he was using school facilities, the stadium, because they have big light show and all that kind of thing. And so it was kind of surprising to say, well, wait a minute, they're not allowing folks in, but apparently they are. So what happens in 2002 that allows these churches to get in? Did somebody else bring this case up? Was it the Bronx Household of Faith constantly complaining since 1995 that allowed different churches to get in?
What happened was, this was weird, and I can explain quite quickly, is that we filed the lawsuit in 1995, lost every step of the way until the Supreme Court denied review in the case in 1998. And then there was basically nothing happened, 1999, 2000. And then there was a case at the United States Supreme Court called the Good News Club case about whether a Christian after-school group could meet in a suburban school in near Albany on the same terms and conditions as like the Boy Scouts and the 4-H Club and the Girl Scouts. And the Supreme Court ruled in June of 2001 that the Christian group could not be excluded. And as an aside, they threw in that the 1997 decision by the Second Circuit against Bronx Household of Faith, in essence, had been wrongly decided, which allowed us to go back into court. And the federal district court judge, Loretta Preska, who's now the chief judge of the Southern District of New York, agreed with us that this was a significant change in the law, and we got an injunction. And so what basically has been happening is that there's been sort of this interesting dynamic of where the trial court judge, Loretta Preska, agrees with us, and we kept getting sent to these panels of three of the 13 judges where two of them agree with the school and one agrees with us. And it's sort of how it gets bounced back and forth. And just procedurally, and I would say by the mercy of God, we keep the injunction alive. But it has really, it's been close calls where it was on life support a couple of times, but we were able to, you know, keep it in place. And but we've been up to the Supreme Court again since then, and they turned us down again. So, and we may be up there again here fairly soon as well. So this is, it's been quite an ordeal and a roller coaster at the same time.
How is the Bronx Household of Faith managing this? You said that's a church that maybe gets 120 or so members showing up on any given Sunday. That's a small church. I would almost think that back in 1995, this is one of these things you just throw up your hands and say, well, I quit. We'll try to find somebody's basement to meet in. And they've been pursuing this now for, you know, almost 20 years. This is, right. There's got to be some fortitude there.
Well, that's exactly right. The Christian commitment and character of the two pastors, Robert Hall Jack Roberts, I'm glad I remembered his name, has been phenomenal. And the people that they attract are very, very dedicated. And, I mean, like, they'll put on, for college students, they'll spend their spring break working at the church from, you know, schools all around the country. And then those college students then move to New York to work with their church. And that's the kind of commitment that they get. And they're in a very poor community. There's probably, and then over the years, you know, Tim Keller has started planting churches with Presbyterian, and the Southern Baptist, the Assemblies of God, and many of these churches are in Some of them are nicer areas, like the Mosaic churches are down in lower Manhattan. And, I mean, you know, everybody needs their religious liberty, no matter what part of New York City that they live in. But in the very wealthy and the very poor areas, many times the only affordable place to meet for a meeting is in a public school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And are other churches being brought into this suit or court case to add assistance, or is it just the lone wolf Bronx household of faith?
Kept it at one. We just have not ever seen a need to add any other churches to it, and that have benefited from the injunction, and and I've gotten to know many, many fine pastors and rabbis and others who run these churches from this lawsuit.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that recently, and I think this was here in early April of 2014, there was a 2-1 ruling against the Bronx Household of Faith in favor of the Board of Education of the City of New York. What was the rationale behind this decision? I mean, let's start with the two judges in the majority there. What was their argument saying Bronx Household, you can't meet in these schools?
Well, they just to set this up so you can see what we were arguing and what they disagreed with. We argued that this violated the free exercise clause, the free exercise of religion clause, because it singled out religion. It said basically any group could meet for any purpose pertaining to the welfare of the community except for a worship service. And we said by singling out a worship service, it violated the free exercise clause under Smith, Lukumi, other major cases. Now, what the other side argued, and I thought that this was a bizarre argument, but the Second Circuit, the majority, the two judges agreed with this, is they latched on to the Supreme Court's decision in 2004 of Locke v. Davey, where they said the Supreme Court upheld a Washington state law that said we will pay for the tuition of Washington residents to go to college, except to go to college to learn to be a minister. And they argued then, okay, and you're thinking like, well, what does that have to do with using a building? And they argued that in New York City, because this is essentially a subsidy, because the real estate is so expensive in New York that if you just pay sort of regular, you know, public government rates to use the auditorium, cafeteria, some classrooms in a public school, well, that's way cheaper than, you know, renting the Ritz-Carlton or the, you know, the Trump Towers or something like that. So the difference between renting the Ritz-Carlton ballroom and the public school, that difference is a subsidy to the churches. And the Second Circuit latched onto this and said, well, this is a subsidy just like Washington State saying we're going to pay money for kids to go to college unless you're going to learn to be a pastor, which I don't even think is analogous, but they said this is a subsidy just like that. Now, even though Locke v. Davey said this does not apply to forum building rental situations, they just ignored that. We kept pointing that out. Plus, we said this is the oddest subsidy in the world because the only money changing hands is the churches paying the school. The school pays out no money. The school will say, oh, well, what we charge doesn't cover all our costs. And I said, well, that's not our problem. That's your problem. You know, I mean, like, you set the rate, we pay it. It's a uniform rate. And I also think that even if this is arguably a subsidy, some sort of in-kind contribution to the churches, the argument really can extend to all sorts of stuff that the Supreme Court has utterly rejected repeatedly. So, for example, you could say, well, the fact that a synagogue can hook up to the city water and sewer system in New York City, that's a subsidy to religion. Or that the fire department and the police department will put out a fire at the Buddhist temple, I mean, and protect them from crime. That's a subsidy too, because they don't have to pay for their own fire and police protection privately or something like that. So it is to me, it warps the concept of subsidy totally out of shape to say that a church or synagogue taking part of a regular government service that's offered uniformly to everybody, that that's a subsidy to religion. And I just think and the Supreme Court has repeatedly rejected that kind of an extensive use of a subsidy argument, but we could not even get the Second Circuit to try to explain away the decisions where the Supreme Court has rejected the very argument they adopted there.
Now, this wasn't a 3-0 decision against Bronx Household, but it was a 2-1. So the two justices favoring the school board argued the subsidy case. What about this one dissenter? Who was that, and what did this person argue?
Judge Walker, who is, I think he's the cousin to George W. Bush, that, you know, from the Walker, the W in George Bush's name stands for Walker, and there's some, I think his dad, and or some, I can't remember what their relation is, but there's some blood relationship there with the president. And he wrote a superb, excellent decision that goes through and just says this is a clear violation of the Free Exercise Clause, this is not a subsidy. And then also pointed out one of our Establishment Clause arguments that we made, which that I learned is that there are some religious groups that do not have worship services. They're usually, like the Quakers, don't have their meetings are not considered worship services. And then there's groups, some Buddhist and Hindu groups, that don't even worship God. They believe that they're pantheistic, they believe everything is God. So they meditate on the God within, but they don't worship God as a separate, distinct being like Judaism and Islam and Christianity do. So what was happening then in New York City was that these groups that don't worship were getting 100% of their meetings approved to meet in the public schools. And these other groups were being denied. And the trial court agreed with us that it violates the Establishment Clause to favor one religious group over another. And the Second Circuit majority just said, now this is basically treating everybody the same, and just didn't really grapple very well with the argument that we had, and said this is fine under the Establishment Clause. And to me, it's the weird thing of, in order to show that the government is neutral towards religion, it treats religion worse than everybody else. And that, to me, is a weird way of showing neutrality.
I can imagine that you could start getting into this parsing of words of what actually a worship service means. Is it a Christian club that meets to pack food groceries for homeless shelters, or if it's a little Bible study group? I mean, is a Bible study group a worship service, like a church service that has, you know, a set list of things that they do all the time, the liturgy? How does that play out here?
Well, that is a very, very excellent question. We had experienced the very reality in this case of what you're talking about. In December of 2011, the Supreme Court denied cert, and there was about a 3-month period before we could get a new injunction in effect, where the mayor didn't want to throw people, the Mayor Bloomberg at that time did not want to throw the people out of Christmas time, but that we had no injunction in effect, but the churches were being allowed to meet. And these very issues that you're talking about happened. So there was a church, for example, that did not use the schools for worship services, but had a Bible study and a prayer meeting. And we put this into evidence of the extensive emails going back and forth from the school quizzing this woman pastor what they did at the prayer meeting and what they did at the Bible study. And finally, the school issued its ruling, maybe from their theology board, I don't know, that said the Bible study was okay, it was not a worship service, but the prayer meeting was. And then they also started doing things like, so we would ask questions like, well, what constitutes a worship service? And the Second Circuit tried to lay out, you know, if you had singing, if you had prayer, if you had preaching, they had a list in their thing. And what the school started to do was, was to go in and look and see on the church's website if they listed, you know, our worship service is at 10 o'clock at, you know, PS 59 or something like that. And so if there was a self-labeling of the meeting as a worship service, the school would say, you're out. You're not going to be able. Now, we were able to stop anybody from getting kicked out by getting a new injunction. But they were telling churches that they would have to leave. And so if they called it a Sunday celebration, if they called it a, you know, community meeting or something like that, and the school officials just got very irritated with us saying, well, that would be, you know, you're saying that the churches would lack integrity and lie about their meetings, and we think they're trustworthy. I said, no, that's not the issue. What you're doing, you're a governmental entity that's under the First Amendment. If you're going to say a worship service is banned, you have to have an objective constitutional definition of that. This can't be the group's own peculiar theology. If that group happens to label their meetings a worship service, they're denied their First Amendment rights. That's crazy as a way to litigate. But again, the Second Circuit said that was okay. You have to do some minimal investigation to see what's going on here. But I think that this was something that's just totally improper for school officials to be doing.
Let me ask you to speculate a little bit about where this case is heading. Now, you received the injunction on the 2-1 ruling that came out early in April. Is this a case that is Supreme Court worthy? It sounded as if it was moving up to Supreme Court before, but was rejected. I'm not sure how this always happens. I'm not very familiar with the legal system. Is there so many times you can dip into that well and try to get it to Supreme Court and they just say enough is enough, or what's happening here?
No, if the case keeps going, we can appeal again. Mm-hmm. Now, unfortunately, I'm assuming we might be appealing up there within the next year. I think the makeup, the nine justices on the court, is going to stay the same, and will be the same nine justices who rejected our appeal back in December of 2011. We are going to keep going. I'm also hoping that the Second Circuit will hear the case. They've been pondering this now for a couple of weeks, which is a good sign. But I could get a court order, you know, later today or tomorrow or something saying that they've turned this down, and we'll have to go up to the U.S. Supreme Court. The other wild card in all of this is what Mayor de Blasio is going to do. During his campaign for mayor, and in fact, before he was the leading candidate, when he was somewhat obscure, during this three-month time in early 2012, when we thought all the churches were going to be evicted, he was the third or fourth place candidate in the polling and all that. He came to many of our rallies to support the right to worship of the churches and synagogues, etc. And he has made public statements since then that he will repeal the policy. So that could cut all of this short, and there would be religious liberty established, and New York City would have a policy like every other major school district in the country has. But we are approaching a month since the decision came down. I mean, came in mayor in January, didn't change the policy. He had 3 or 4 months before the decision came down. He's been slow in replacing this. Right now, it hasn't happened because of what we've been doing in court. We've kept this bad decision at bay. It'll just be interesting to see what the mayor does and whether he's going to act quickly on his promise or not.
It does seem rather interesting, as you mentioned earlier in the interview, that 49 of the 50 major school districts have no problem with this, but there's just one. You would think that either the courts, the justices, or mayor would say, what's wrong with us if all the other 49 are
right
doing something? So I guess that's kind of interesting. But that is in New York City, and there's a lot of politics going on with the school boards and different
sure.
people and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, you would expect this kind of conflict maybe to happen in New York City, but there are other places around the country that you would figure such church-state conflict would not actually occur. And there are a few other cases that are on the docket that are very interesting related to property rights. And some of these are in Arizona, of all places. And I figured Arizona would not be a place that there'd be many church-state conflicts, but maybe apparently there are. I want to talk about two of the interesting cases that have arisen here. And one of those, let's start with the first one here, being the Church of the Isaiah 58 Project of Arizona versus La Paz County. Now, again, that's another really long name for a court case. I think they got to start shortening these names a little bit. But
that's right. This is in Quartzsite, Arizona, which is a small town right on the border between California and Arizona. So if you're going on, I think it's Interstate 10, and I have driven through Quartzsite before, and it's a very, very small town, and it's total desert, you know, around this. And this is a church, that evangelical Christian church, that has had a real vision for helping the poor. They during the winter months, which is quite beautiful in Arizona, they have soup kitchens, and they basically try to reach out by, you know, job training, all sorts of stuff like this. And where I think that the trip up came with this is that the IRS code does not require a church to be in order to be tax exempt under the IRS code, you don't have to apply in this formal fashion and get some letter from the IRS that says your Isaiah 58 church is officially tax exempt. You just are tax exempt if you're set up as a church. And I mean, I guess this could be challenged. It was somehow, you know, a fraudulent, you know, Church of Bob, you know, guy, mm-hmm. you know, donating his own money to the church or something. But when it's a normal, you know, run-of-the-mill situation, you don't have to get this. Well, the property tax assessor in La Paz County said, you have to give me an IRS letter or you're not going to be tax exempt. And he said, well, you know, we don't have to do that. So it doesn't, like, you're asking us to do a very lengthy, expensive process to give you a letter to do what the federal law says we already have. And so they went back and forth for several years. They finally got a letter from the Arizona tax officials basically saying, hey, this group is tax exempt. But what the 2 years that this battle took place, the tax assessor said, you got to pay property taxes on this property that you have bought. And it amounted to about approximately $50,000. And then tragically, they got caught up in this, which is a frequent requirement. If there is a dispute between an individual or an organization and the government over the taxes, the usual legal requirement is you have to pay the taxes and then challenge it. Well, the church, that's their annual budget, is $50,000. They just didn't have, you know, here, we'll write this check and then, you know, challenge it and get the money back. And they just didn't pay it. And their church was basically put up for a tax lien sale. And so it just was like all these problems just began to compound. And ADF stepped in and we won at the trial court. But then the Arizona Court of Appeals and ruled against us and said, you know, on this kind of technical issue of like, you should have paid before you challenged. And the Arizona Supreme Court turned the case down, and so now this church is going to have to pay $50,000 just because of some slow-moving property tax official in La Paz County.
And I can't imagine that La Paz County is a very big county. I mean, not geographically it might be, but it doesn't sound like it's the major county that is housing Phoenix, Arizona. And
No. It's Maricopa County. No, that you're exactly. There is. Quartzsite is very, very, you know, they probably get more people driving through it on their way to California or back than actually live there.
And this kind of surprises me because I tend to be a rural guy and, you know, folks out in the rural area, you know, you all kind of get along. There aren't that many folks out there, so you just try to minimize conflict. What is possibly minimizing the county officials to really pursue this church? It just seems that it's a, you know, $50,000, I guess, could be a lot of money for the county, but, you know, hey, is it worth the battle here? I don't know.
Well, this that's a good question. And for this case in particular, I do not know. But I would say from other cases that I had, I will make a general statement, and I would not be surprised if it applies here, is that government officials view churches as an irritation that over the fact that they don't pay taxes, that they're tax exempt. And so it's sort of like, oh, here come the freeloaders. They're taking land off the rolls that we really need to run our city or county government. And this is just so irritating. And what I think is interesting is that they never consider a benefit to the community that's intangible and worthy of a tax break. So, for example, like if they're helping people keep their marriages together, helping parents to discipline their children better, there's, you know, fewer discipline problems in the public schools, you know, crime rate is less, you know, there's just, you know, if they're helping the poor, like this church is, that's tax money that doesn't have to be spent helping the poor. And then plus they're giving them the spiritual support that they need, and which the government might have some establishment clause issues with that. So they're like, hey, win-win. You know, give them a tax exemption, let them do their thing. And so instead, this piece of land where the church building was, and in fact, I'm not sure currently, I mean, if they've, you know, been, people have heard their plight and donated money to help them out, and I'm not quite sure where that's all at. But it has nonetheless jeopardized the very place that was the source of all, where all many of the community members were finding help, and for $50,000. And I bet if the place closes down, the city will, the county, I should say, will pay more than $50,000 to replace the services, the help that this church was providing for free that they wiped out with this ill-advised. And then the irony of it is that once they got this tax letter from the Arizona officials, they granted them a tax-exempt status from 2009 on. But for the two earlier years, that's where they demanded the $50,000. So it's all they had to do was extend their decision back to 2007 when they first got the letters, and everything would have been fine. So it's very tragic.
Are there a lot of these tax cases that crop up? I guess I'm surprised, too, that this is happening in La Paz County, Arizona, where, you know, I've been in Arizona a few times, and there's a lot of open space and sand there. So one wouldn't think you need this piece of property out here. It's going to be tax exempt. But don't worry, there's a lot of it out here in the town of Courtside. It's not big a deal.
I've had two relatively smaller areas of Minnesota and of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I would say that this is, again, I do not know about the specifics of this Arizona case where this was the mindset, if we had evidence of this. But I think it's two things that will come up, that they'll say, this church wants to meet in the area where we're trying to get commercial development. Mm-hmm. And so if we get a tax-exempt property right in the middle of the commercial area, it means they're occupying a piece of land that a commercial building can't get. And then plus they just view it as sort of a negative to, you know, what businesses are going to want to locate when there's a church there kind of being a killjoy or, you know, odd man out or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is that I remember I had a case with a Christian camp that was denied tax exemption under in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And they clearly met the statutory definition, but the county basically, or the city, said, we need the tax money, so we're just going to try to, you know, impose taxes on them and see if we can get away with it. Now, we were able to be successful in that case and defeat that, but I think that that's the kind of motivations that even in these rural areas where they'll say no to churches.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, here's another court case in Arizona, and this one almost seems trivial, but these trivial things can actually have a very big impact on church attendance and outreach. And this one is involving signage, those small sandwich boards that you might see a real estate agent putting out on the side of the road to advertise that a house is for sale, or a banner sign that you might connect up to a chain link fence or something like that.
Yeah.
The signs here are not real estate signs. They're signs dealing with telling people about a worship service that will be happening. And this court case, I find kind of interesting, is called Reed versus Town of Gilbert. What's going on there?
Well, Gilbert is a very nice, up-and-coming, you know, rapid-growth suburb on the southeast side of Phoenix. And I live in Washington, D.C. area now, but I used to live very close to Gilbert in Phoenix when I worked at the ADF headquarters, Alliance Defending Freedom headquarters in Scottsdale. And I lived in a town right next to Gilbert. And so you want to have this vision of, you know, all these newly minted homes that, you know, look like upgrades of the Alamo being, you know, put up on, you know, empty patches of land, and the big, the Walmart going in, and the Costco, and all these new developments. And that'll give you the flavor of what Gilbert is like. And Gilbert has one of the most bizarre and, to me, unconstitutional policies that I have ever seen. And their signage requirements on how big your sign can be and how long you can have it out depends upon the message. So if you're trying to sell the house, for example, you know, it's some developer trying to sell homes, you can have a sign up to 80 square feet and it can basically be up indefinitely. If it's a political sign for a campaign, 32 square feet, you know, you get the idea. It has some... But if it's a church that's meeting, like, temporarily in a school, like the Bronx Household of Faith, if they're meeting, now they can meet in the Gilbert Public Schools, no problem. They can only put up their signs 6 square feet and can be displayed for no longer than 14 hours. But if they said, open a house at the ABC developers, development of new housing, they'd have a much bigger sign that they could have up for much longer. And, so now we have lost that case, and we've appealed it to the United States Supreme Court. But the good news there is that the Supreme Court looks like the way that they are acting procedurally, that they have put this case on hold for another case that they are deciding, oddly enough, on a Massachusetts law restricting abortion clinic protesters and sidewalk counselors around abortion clinics in Massachusetts. That's also been claimed that it's condemned. Like, if you're pro-abortion, you can go anywhere. If you're against abortion, you're limited and have to stand far away. And we think what they're going to do is when that case gets decided, which could be any time now in May or June, they will then send back this Gilbert case to the lower courts and say, review this case in light of our decision here. That's the procedural behavior that the Supreme Court is doing would imply that's what's going on here.
Now, I can understand the view of Gilbert not wanting to have lots of signs placed all over the place. This seems to be a local community deciding we want to have a nice look to the community.
Right.
So let's not put up lots of billboards with neon signs flashing and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of get that. But what is interesting here is the restriction on square footage based upon the message of the actual sign. I don't think I've ever seen that before, although I don't sit down and read, you know, city ordinances on sign.
You're right, though. You're right. I mean, when I read our petition for review to the Supreme Court, I felt like I was reading a constitutional law exam question, you know, like a law school exam question, because it was like where they, you know, try to lay out a specific case so the students can identify the issues, because it just seems so blatantly unconstitutional. But so far, the federal courts have upheld this thing, And I also want to make sure that people, you know, I threw out numbers like 80 square feet, 32 square feet. These are not like huge billboard type. If you're driving by, these are they're more like sandwich signs. I think that you mentioned that's probably the biggest one would be like a sandwich sign, and so this is not some big, you know, like they're gonna, you know, look like some. You know, wreck all the, and these are temporary signs, too, that they're usually put up on either the medians or on the corners to direct people, you know, either vote for this guy or, you know, turn right at the next corner to get to our real estate development, you know, that sort of thing. And I have never, and to me, there's a lot of those signs from living out there, and they've never been viewed as, like, obtrusive as when you drive through some area where they have big, huge billboards, you know, every 10 feet, it seems like.
Yeah, the political signs seem to get the most space there.
Yeah.
You understand that every October, every other year, you're going to see all these signs at corners on chain link fences, you know, vote for Schmo and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it's just it's rather interesting. It's interesting, too, that there are some heavy hitters weighing in on this little tiny case of religious signage in Gilbert, Arizona, and people from different ends of the political spectrum. You have Eugene Volokh of UCLA, go Bruins, I'm a UCLA grad, and then you also have Nadine Strossen of the NYU Law School, I think was the president of the ACLU.
That's so, correct, yes.
Yeah, this little case is drawing lots of attention.
Yeah, I think because it's such a extreme violation of the First Amendment, and we are hopeful in light of what the Supreme Court has been doing procedurally by pulling this case off their list of cases that they're considering. That is classic Supreme Court behavior, that we're going to send this case back down once we decide another case that the justices view as dealing with related issues.
Okay, we have a little bit of time left for one more case, and this case is almost a reverse image of the one that we talked about in La Paz County, where the county was saying, well, you have this land here and it needs to be taxed, and they're concerned about using the land for other space. This one is out in Georgia, and it's the case of the New Generation Christian Church versus Rockdale County. And here, the county government is saying that the plot of land that the church is meeting on is too small for its zoning ordinance. That one is somewhat amazing. What's happening here?
Well, yeah, this is a community that's east of Atlanta and Conyers, Georgia, if people are familiar with that. And they have a restriction. So I want to make this clear. It's not like they have a building or something that's too big or something for their piece of land or something like that. The number of people that they have in the church is relatively small, and the building they have is fine for the amount of property they have. And I can't remember now exactly how big it is, but it's less than 3 acres. There's just this requirement that any church that starts or whatever, or, you know, that meets, has to be on a property that's 3 acres or larger. Which means, now, if people can envision how big 3 acres are, that's a pretty, you could have a pretty good-sized church building on 3 acres of land. It's not a mega church, but you would, so if you're having like 50 people or 100 people, this is going to start creating a problem if you have to have 3 acres of land. So there's no disputes about crowdedness or the parking or something. It's just arbitrary. And the good news here is that we, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom, filed a lawsuit, and the county backed down and agreed to a federal court injunction, and so the church is allowed to meet. But to me, this is just sort of a crazy requirement that it's much better to have neutral rules on depending on how big or small the facility is. Now, what's weird about this is that it only applied to churches. So that if you had, you know, a daycare center or a movie theater, some performing arts center, educational institution, there was no 3 acre minimum. So like, there would have been at least something arguably better if there was some sort of across the board for sort of, you know, similar facilities to churches, you know, private clubs, etc. But there wasn't. Churches were the only ones that had this requirement.
And this must be a barrier for small churches, because a lot of churches start out as small Bible study groups. And again, we're getting into the definition of what constitutes a church. I mean, is a Bible study that meets regularly and is led by the most charismatic person in the group of maybe 25 or 30 meeting at somebody's house or somebody's local business, is that a church? And if they don't have 3 square acres,
No, I think that that's exactly right, because it basically, if you view like a church starting and it's at the bottom of a ladder and it wants to climb up the ladder, an ordinance like this, you know, knocks out about the first 2 or 3 rungs of the ladder. So the church has to somehow, on its own, without a meeting place, get to a certain size, a critical mass, where they can afford to get 3 acres and a building that's on 3 acres to meet. So this definitely is a huge entrance barrier to new churches and other religious groups starting.
Do you see other cases like this around the United States where they have to have certain minimal size requirements, or is this just really unique to Georgia?
We have seen this in other places. I think this is a bit unusual, although I'm not the expert on this, on how widespread this is. I will say the thing that I find that is widespread, that pops up with some frequency, is communities where there is no place in the zoning ordinance where a church has the right to meet as a matter of right, that they have to apply for a special use permit anywhere that they meet. And now, back in the day of, like, the 80s, 90s, and earlier, when pornography theaters were more the common way to dispense the evils of pornography, the Supreme Court said you cannot have a zoning ordinance that says there's no place for a pornography theater to operate. It has to get a special use permit. You had a city said the Constitution requires a city to allow a pornography theater to meet somewhere as of right. Huh. And I remember I argued a case at the Federal Appeals Court for the Eighth Circuit in Minnesota and said, we asked this court to find that churches have the same First Amendment rights that pornography theaters do when it comes to zoning ordinances. So that's the kind of thing that's a problem out there.
Hmm.
And that's why groups like ADF are out there fighting, and we have Congress has passed, the Religious Land Use, the RLUIPA Act, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, which makes this also a violation of federal law as well as the federal constitution, to have these bizarro zoning ordinances that limit religious groups in ways that nobody else is limited.
I have one final question here as we end up our time. And
sure.
You get to see a large number of these cases either coming across your desk directly or through your organization, Alliance Defending Freedom. From your vantage point, and over the past 30 or so years that you've been doing this, have things seemed to have gotten better or worse for churches in terms of defending their property rights?
Boy, that is a really good question. And I would say I think in some areas it's better, and in some areas it's worse. The equal access stuff, except in New York City, being able to meet in public schools is better. But to me, it is very sad that many government officials view churches as a negative burden in their community. They don't pay taxes. They don't really help people. They're like this sort of insular water buffalo club or something like that. And, they'd rather not have them there. And I think that has produced a number of problems. And I wish that they would see the value that many of these churches do in these intangible ways of just improving the quality of life for many, many people, which in effect then saves the government lots and lots of money that they don't have to pay for the human carnage from, marriages breaking up, et cetera.
Well, I want to thank Jordan Lawrence for helping us survey some of the things that are going on in the legal environment now related to houses of worship. Jordan, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you. You betcha.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.